I'm Christopher Leiden. This is Open Source. At home with Gunther Schuller in the last year of an unschooled, unconventional, amazingly productive career in music. He talked with us much the way he lived and composed over the years. Across all the boundaries of new and old, jazz and classical, he was intimately and equally at ease with Bach and Bill Evans, Toscanini and Duke Ellington. He made it into the orchestra of the Metropolitan Opera in New York in his teens in the 1940s on the French horn, the same horn he played with Miles Davis's Birth of the Cool Nonet in the 1950s. In the 60s and 70s, he revived the New England Conservatory and inside it revived ragtime jazz, which became the soundtrack of the Robert Redford, Paul Newman blockbuster movie, The Sting. This conversation fell on a workday afternoon in 2014. In his 89th year, Gunther Schuller had a dozen or more commissions for new pieces in his own atonal mode. We're hearing one of his seven studies on themes of Paul Klee. He had just published a first volume of memoir titled A Life in Pursuit of Music and Beauty. It ran 600 pages through the 1950s in the Manhattan of his boyhood, what he remembered as day and night a cultural paradise for all the world.
And I say that because, first of all, by the end of the 30s, with all the programs that the New Deal had created for artists and musicians, and there was no materialism possible, so people turned onto themselves and they found things that they didn't know they could do. So there was this indigenous growth of the music. But even greater than that, between, let's say, 1940 and after the war, we inherited all the people that Hitler sent us. they escaped, of course, and they enriched our culture even more than that. And, you know, whether it's Thomas Mann or Schoenberg or Stravinsky or you know, half the great directors in Hollywood were Germans or Viennese. Mm. But I feasted on that in all the ways that I could. You mentioned some of it. I mean, we almost literally didn't sleep, my wife and I. It was so exciting and so much to see and hear. For example, a given day might be the following. I'm playing, let's say, Carmen at the opera in the afternoon. And in the evening, there's, of all things, one of the longest operas ever, Meistersinger, which lasts actually 4.5 hours. But they had made cuts in it, so it ended just a little bit after 12. And then my wife met me at the door, and then we walked up Broadway. And there we went to one of seven clubs that was just on Broadway, Royal Roost, Erlang most particularly, but the Aquarium. Duke Ellington played there all the time. Child's Restaurant chain had jazz. I mean, it was just all over. Then there's 7th Avenue, which goes at an angle from Broadway. There was another seven clubs. And on the side streets, there was Boplicity, where everybody played. And then, if that wasn't enough, I could go to 52nd Street, where Billie Holiday was. So I'm telling you, we were both just so fanatically involved with this, which eventually is, you can describe it as learning and as growing from all of these influences.
But there was literally no time for sleep in that schedule, and it seemed to work fine with your constitution.
Well, it is true that I went on a regimen of only 4 hours a night. That came rather early. When I was 18, my mother was telling me how you gotta get 8 hours sleep every night, and the doctors all say so. Yeah, okay, I listened to that, and then I figured out, God damn it, if I sleep 8 hours every night, I'm gonna piss away 1/3 of my life. No, I'm serious. My horn playing did not get worse, all my writing, all my activities, and I was just lucky that I was one of those persons who could actually live on 4 hours sleep. And I did that for then 50, 60 years of my professional life. Hmm. And can you imagine how much I accomplished 2 hours earlier in the day and 2 hours at the end of every day? And I always felt well, you know, just in terms of all the music that I studied when I was young. You know, I began composing, I began getting into music very late, at age 11. Usually people start 6 or 7, play an instrument or piano or something. I started very late, and the first thing I wanted to be was a composer. So in all those years from 11 to 15, 16, and on from there, I collected a lot of records, and I listened to all the music on the recordings, and I followed with the score. So by the way, I never had a teacher. My teaching was scores and hearing the music and analyzing it and studying it that way. The other teacher was playing in a great orchestra. Because when I played for those 15 years in the Metropolitan Opera, I tell you, until you hear music inside of an orchestra, I could even feel the vibrations on the floor of the pit. Mm. I mean, that is an experience you cannot have any other way. In other words, to be surrounded by this world of music in such an intimate way. And I, of course, I almost hate to say this, many musicians had been there for many years, but they were pretty blasé about all this. But me, as a young composer, you know, exciting to learn, I just feasted on that too, you know. But then again, on the other side, at home, when I discovered some recordings that became very important in my life, one of them is a composer named Frederick Delius. Most people don't know about him very much, but a great, great English composer. And he wrote in what is a post-Wagnerian chromatic style. And Sir Thomas Beecham had made, by the time I got around to buying records, 6 volumes of the music of Frederick Delius. And it is so beautiful, such beautiful music. There's one piece, it's on a poem by Walt Whitman. At the end of the piece, it is so moving that I have never conducted it without crying at the end of the piece. It's so overwhelming. You know, you can't cry. You can't fake a cry. Mm. Actors do, but you really can't. Another great conductor, Stokowski, he was the first to record work by Alexander Scriabin. Mm. And this is the same kind of post-Wagnerian chromatic music which I grew up with, which was then still new music. And Scriabin got a hold of me, I tell you, for 3 or 4 months, I just immersed myself in his music, both the recordings and all the scores. I studied every piece he ever wrote. Mm. And my parents were worried about me because I just locked myself in my room and I didn't sleep, I didn't eat, I didn't do anything. They thought I was going mad. It was so deep. And of course, by then I had already absorbed Stravinsky, Debussy, Ravel, Mio, some of the more moderns, you know. So I just did all this studying. It's another reason why I didn't want to sleep very much.
It also reminds me of this extraordinary gift. I don't know anybody who has it the way you do. Liszt had it, but being able to go from the text to the sound back and forth interchangeably. You are famous for your transcriptions of a very hard to describe jazz solos.
Yeah,
that's part of your what, synesthesia or something?
Listen, by the way, it wasn't solos. What I was the first to do, and by the way, I started this at age 17 in Cincinnati, to transcribe from the recordings the whole performance.
Yes.
By the time I left Cincinnati, I had transcribed at least 10 pieces of Duke Ellington's. Mm. And every detail, what the drummer played, whatever was on that I could hear on that record. Because I wanted to, you see, my ears are very good still, and were very good. And I could, of course, hear it all, but I wanted to see what it looked like and compare it that way to my classical music, you see. And I became obsessed with that. Then I did another extraordinary thing. I hope nobody thinks I'm bragging here, but I say it in all humility because I was so amazed that I could do this. One of the great composers of the Second Viennese School, Alban Berg, a recording of his greatest work, perhaps, the violin concerto, came out while I was in Cincinnati. That blew my mind. I mean, these pieces all overwhelmed me, you know, for a while. And I said, my God, I'm going to buy the score. I want to see how can this happen? And I found out that the score was not available in the entire United States. It what few copies had gotten to the United States before World War II had all been sold out. And here I am, and I can't even look at a score. And I said, God damn it, I'm going to do something. And so I copied from the recording the whole last 12-inch side, which was about 4.5 minutes of music. And I did not know what the instrumentation was. I didn't know whether there were two trombones or three. I didn't know how many oboes there were. But never mind, I put down all the notes that I could recognize. And this is now hardcore atonal music. And my girlfriend of that time, she became my wife, Marjorie, she said, you're crazy. And of course, again, I spend all nights doing that. And so this was all in my teaching and in my learning. I just have this, even to this voracious appetite for learning. I'm still a student, I just, but transcribing an atonal piece, man, nobody has ever done that.
The other thing that's so peculiar about you, Gunther, is that you mastered these different musics in great depth. I mean, there are a lot of amateur listeners who love jazz and classical, but there you were walking across those streets every day of your life. What did it take to be able to see those very different kinds of traditions as equally gifted but equally important?
It's because they're equal.
We're at home in Newton Center with Gunther Schuller in the last year of his life. He's working hard through his leukemia. All musics were created equal, he insisted, but then they all grew up different. Coming up, how Stravinsky's Rite of Spring changed him. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Leiden. This is Open Source. With Gunther Schuller, who died at 89 this summer. He worked, wrote, played, and taught on both sides of the gulf between jazz and classical music, with big ears and complete confidence in the pleasure of being surprised.
One person amongst probably at least 25 composers of my generation who became composers because the greatest masterpiece of the 20th century, The Rite of Spring. If a piece can be perfect, which is almost impossible, that anything can be really perfect, that piece is it. In the language, the bitonal, polytonal, almost atonal language that he used, which was coming in, you know, it wasn't going to stop, that happened at the end of the 19th century because people were so mesmerized, composers were so mesmerized with Wagner's chromaticism that they pushed that even further. And Stravinsky then did that in what is a very Russian tradition of harmony, which came out of his teacher, Rimsky-Korsakov. So anyway, there's this whole dramatically advanced harmonic language. Then there is the total breakdown of the rhythms of a piece, the meters. For the first 40 or 50 years of my life, I'm not bragging. I said, I can analyze any kind of piece, but this one I cannot. And I once had a conversation with Pierre Boulez about that, and he said, you know, this we cannot explain. I could go into a lot of details, even how the piece starts with a bassoon all alone on some damn high note, which bassoons weren't even supposed to be able to play. The bassoon is soon joined by a second horn with one little note accompanying the bassoon. And in those three bars, every rhythm between a quarter note and any subdivisions of the quarter note and half note is in that one little solo. The meter changes are just incessant. I mean, they come and go all the time, and rhythms that had never been written before that time. Dotted eighths, an eighth, quintuplet, a quarter note, a half note. I mean, in three bars to use every rhythm. That, you know, in 1913, that went way beyond anybody else. But then you have, you know, these incredible things. There's this one dance, I forget what it's called, where the music goes like this. Pum, 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 you know. And then it's interrupted by trumpets going, pum, 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 pum. Come on. Next to Wagner, even, that's, I get goose pimples just thinking about it. Years and years, decades, orchestras who could not play it at all. And then there were orchestras like New York Philharmonic and some others that finally got to play it almost correctly. There's a recording by Stravinsky conducted in New York Philharmonic where there are still mistakes in the parts. That's how hard that was.
Think of the music and the transformations in your time, Günter Schuller, and explain it as maybe only you could to the rest of us who are just listening with more and less pleasure, but not much grasp. What happened in the 20th century?
No, Chris, this cannot be explained in any simple way. So much about the creative process is really not known. I mean, we know some things about it, but there is this other thing where something comes to an artist, whether it's a musician or a writer or choreographer, I don't care, that had never occurred to anybody. We do not know how and why that happens. One can say something that had happened prior to that time sort of had an influence to give someone an inspiration to take that idea a little bit further. But why exactly it happens and where it comes from, I've experienced that many times where I'm doing a piece and I'm doing, you know, my language, my style, and suddenly comes to something to me, and I don't know why it came, and because these things come very quickly, every time such a thing happens and almost interrupts the composing that I'm doing, I have to write down what I just, this new inspiration that came, because in seconds I will lose it. I will, you know, these things evaporate quickly. But it is that thing where somebody did something, a musical idea, and somebody, this is simplistic, almost says, gee, let me turn this sort of upside down and do it in a different meter. I mean, that's really simplistic, but just even that, that's what sometimes happened. Now, when it comes to the degree of invention, as in the Rite of Spring, then that's really totally... some of the music in that is from Rimsky-Korsakov, who was his teacher, but I would say only maybe 10, 15%. You can say, that's his teacher. And all the rest of it comes from somewhere. Imagination comes along with inspiration. I have been inspired by paintings. I've been inspired by other music, of course. I've been inspired by books, literature, poetry, many ways. I even was inspired in one of my first big pieces for the New York Philharmonic by a funny thing like this. I was coming back from Europe, and I had a window seat, and I looked out the window, and I saw a formation in a cloud. I saw a cloud, and I saw, wait a minute, I can take that shape and put it into music. Can you explain that?
Explain what a lot of people, and maybe me, feel though is a tremendous loss of altitude, loss of audience in what you guys call serious music in the post-Schoenberg period, running headlong into this tremendous revitalization of music coming from Africa, from the Caribbean, from Cuban, Brazilian music, into popular music. That to me is the great story of music in my lifetime, how the Viennese tradition became what I call the Havana tradition.
All right.
It relates somehow to what you dubbed third stream and a kind of multiplication of the possibilities of so-called serious, real, first-class, brilliant, wonderful music.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, look, I started that whole thing about third stream, and the term isn't used so much now anymore, but this was very simple for me. When I was young, this wonderful thing in our culture was one of the many wonderful things that I've already mentioned, that there were two kinds of music only two kinds of music here in the United States. Country music, and those things hadn't yet come into, the only inkling of that was the Grand Ole Opry House program. It was just sneaking in on radio. So there was classical music and there was jazz. Guess what was so wonderful about that? Of all adult Americans, 50% loved and collected classical music, and 50% loved jazz. Mm. So the entire population was involved with their music, of very great music, because both jazz and classical are enormously great musics by that time. Mm. But what was terrible and horrible, that these musics didn't speak to each other. This was racial undertones where the white musicians looked down upon jazz. Not the musicians, all white people, more or less, looked down upon jazz as a degenerate music, cheap music. My father, all those German refugees that came here, they couldn't understand jazz. They thought it was some kind of barbarian nonsense or something. But the thing is, I said, this great music that is born on this soil, and by that time, you know, I'm saying this in 1946, and, you know, the music had come into our world already 50 years earlier and had developed with the swing era already a tremendous tradition. And for people to say that this is lousy music, there were articles against jazz. I mean, Ladies' Home Companion, they had articles where the author wrote, don't let your children listen to jazz. They will get pimples or they will get gonorrhea. I'm not kidding. And I said, God damn it, we got to do something. Here's a really great music. And a lot of people love it. 50% of our population loves it. And the other side does too, but they don't talk to each other. They hate each other. And so I had this simplistic idea that the mainstream of jazz and the mainstream of classical music would marry. And as it says in the Bible, they would beget a child. And that was from the first and second stream comes the third stream.
This is Gunther with Jim Hall, a piece called Variants on a Theme by Thelonious Monk.
To make this worth doing is you really have to know the two musics or the three musics or the four musics that you're putting together absolutely authentically. Mm. You cannot predict what this amalgam is going to sound like,
yeah.
But except in my sense of the purest way of talking about third stream, that all these things are treated equally, really deeply, and then put together. And one can then say, well, okay, we didn't actually have two great composers like Mozart and Beethoven, but we had one anyway. See, Ellington is on that same line for me.
Absolutely.
Because by any analysis, all the criteria, how we study the ingredients that went into a piece of music, whether, you know, it's rhythm, harmony, color, instrumentation, tempo variety, all this stuff, the forms. When you put all that together, there is a very clear development of the greatest composers doing that at the highest possible level through their talent and their industry. And if we do this now in a new language, does that make it less? No, that's what the prevailing opinion is. But that cannot be held. I discovered Duke Ellington one night, and the next morning I was just overwhelmed by the sounds of the Ellington Orchestra. The next morning I told my father in all seriousness, you know, Pop, you know, this Ellington music, my God, it's in the hands of such a great composer, it's just as good as Beethoven, classical music. And he nearly had a heart attack. But I still maintain that, because when something is perfect, as you've already mentioned, no matter what its label is, if something is perfect, well, then it's perfect. It might be totally different, just as jazz of Duke Ellington is totally different from Beethoven. Different instrumentation, different instruments, different ways of harmonizing and all of that. If it comes out on that higher top, then they go into the pantheon. And I think that's so beautiful that there can be this enormous pantheon stretching across the whole variety of styles and musical languages.
You've had a long lifetime in music, and your imagination, your knowledge of the tradition goes hundreds of years. In the case of China, you know, we're talking 3,000 years. But I want to ask you sort of report to the ancestors, report to all the ancestors on music in this 21st century. There are more ways to listen than ever before, and of course record and preserve. But how's it doing?
Well, I think we're doing quite well. Sometimes I feel like I mentioned about certain things in jazz that we could do better. But, you know, there is no way that one can... I wouldn't be able to argue that this music is worse than the music of the past or that it's better than. It simply is on the same high level in the hands of the greatest practitioners of that particular style and language.
We're going into the break with Duke Ellington's Bakif. Coming up, Gunter Schuller's close encounters with jazz and the giants who sought him out. This is Open Source. Christopher Leiden, this is Open Source, with Gunter Schuller, the omni musician who wrote the canonical histories, early jazz, and the swing era. He heard it all with an uncanny extra gift for writing down the notes and rhythms in improvised sound. He knew the giants in the music, and of course he had his favorites.
Duke Ellington's practically on every page, every one of your 600 pages, but you have special fixations too on Lawrence Brown, the trombone player. I always imagine he's playing your voice in those arrangements. It's a horn like your own. But you're also a Ben Webster guy to a fare thee well. I mean, speak about some of them as these transcendent musical guys.
Well, the thing about Lawrence Brown was he was a trombone, and as you've sort of implied, the trombone is very near to the French horn. It's the same range. And when I first, we might be talking about is luck, things that happen to me. And you know already from millions of interviews you've done, many, many artists and actors and all that, they say, by the way, we should mention, a lot of this is luck. Luck, in my case, just the sheer luck of being born in New York. But anyway, what happened is that I was fortunate to hear Duke Ellington four times in my 2 years in Cincinnati. This was such a rich orchestra. And the colors of that orchestra, this 16-piece orchestra, had absolutely as much color, variety, timbre, as any symphony orchestra, or at least almost close to that. So that, as a composer who's very much into the color of the instruments, you know, the oboe color is different from a flute and clarinet. Even there's a difference between trombone and horn to some extent. That is one of the things that I have by heritage or something, the love of musical colors. So here was this 16-piece group and, you know, doing all these incredible things. And he had the ear and the genius to exploit that to the fullest. You know, the Countess Koenigs, what's her name?
Koenigswasser or whatever.
Yeah, something like that. She had this huge apartment near the United Nations building, and that was a hangout for musicians. And by the way, when you walked into those whatever number of rooms it was, man, you would get high just by being in there. I mean, God. And there wasn't very much furniture in half of that place. There were just mattresses on the floor. And so all the musicians gathered there. You know, just as they wanted to. And she opened house, you know. I mean, this is legendary. Everybody's written about that. Well, one night I went there. I wanted to meet somebody. I can't remember who. And I lay down on one of these mattresses, and I kind of held my nose and ears. And And Bird comes along. Oh, hey, Charlie, and you know, and he stayed, and he lay down on the mattress near me, and we talked about things and bad and good in jazz and society and so on. These people, by the way, whether it's Dizzy Gillespie or Miles or Charlie Parker or Monk, they were so deep in thinking about social matters, and you know, as well they might.
Sonny Rollins, yeah. Too.
Oh man. My God, you know, Dizzy was seen as a clown so much. Well, boy, was he ever a serious person in all other ways. But anyway, we lay there for a while, and he said, you know, Gunther, I can't stand it anymore. And he started sort of, you know, I've played every kind of music I can play. I've played every kind of blues that I can play. I can't do it anymore because I know there's, I'm paraphrasing of it, I know there's out there this great other music and I so much want to learn it. I've heard, and he mentioned particularly Bartok's Concerto for Orchestra, which he had heard by, I think John Lewis had told him to listen to it, you know, because John was doing the same kind of thing, like trying to get some musicians more enriched in the other language. And it was terrifying. He started almost crying. He said, I want to study with you. And I said, of course, of course. And then it never happened, A, because one time he said he was going to come. He never showed up. And another time, his saxophone was in a hawk shop. Yeah.
Pawn shop.
Yeah, pawn shop, yeah. And for some reason, again, he didn't come up. And then 3 months later, he died.
You love Ben Webster in a particular way.
Well, yes, he had another one of these totally individual styles. At least by the time he came around to Ellington in his early days, he was a Coleman Hawkins follower, and of course he played, had an enormous technique. But he turned in his later years, including that fabulous period with Ellington, into a lyric player and a ballad player. And, I mean, his music is so, how shall I put it, it's so deeply moving. It's almost, I mean, certainly sensual, and it might even be sexual for all I know. I'm telling you, the way he moves into notes, this subtle coloring and sliding, and it's so rich in warmth. And both Larry Brown and Ben Webster, and I could name probably, if my memory didn't fail me, 20 others who were really lyric players. That is something that had to be in jazz. And Ellington was the one who really did that. Nowadays, ballad playing is way down. Everybody plays highly technical stuff, you know, 30-second notes running around, you know. And because that was the width and breadth of Ellington. And any great composer, that they can go from the harshest, most exciting, dramatic music to the simplest, soulful music. And so many orchestras didn't have that range, you know, not to the extent of Ellington.
You write about the kind of overwhelming effect of hearing Lester Young at a particular moment, and he was surrounded with great players, including Billie Holiday and others, but there was something that just, I don't know, took your breath away.
That was that famous broadcast that, which was the last great program on television in jazz, where somebody got all these great musicians together and about four or five or six or seven different groups and some added people. And the thing that I was referring to, particularly in that television film, was that Lester and Billy, they hadn't seen each other for a while. And I kind of feel they were in love with each other. Lester was so in such bad shape at that time that the producer had begun to decide, you know, we can't have him perform. He can't do it. But then they had a meeting amongst the musicians, and And they finally said, no, listen, we cannot do this program without Lester Young. So even whatever happens. And so then he played, and he played only 12 bars. I'm gonna choke up now. And Billy sang it 1,000 times. And she stood there about 10 feet away from him, looking at him. And I mean, if you ever saw love expressed on a film and in this music, that was that moment.
So many of these names mean everything. I saw you, I don't know, 6 or 8 years ago, we were crossing in a big ballroom or something, and you said, by the way, nobody has ever appreciated Errol Garner for the complete, you know, out-of-this-world genius that he was. And he was sort of my first, he was my gateway drug. I mean, Concert by the Sea just took all of my brothers and sisters by storm.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about Errol.
Well, it's so tragic that he has been virtually forgotten. And what he had, first of all, real swing. I mean, you could not sit still. It's like Basie. You can't not do something with your fingers or your feet or something. But he had that just on the piano. And, of course, and then he had only a bass, who played a very modest secondary role. But the thing that ultimately just killed me, and I still don't understand how he could do that. All the pianists, before and after, have played the piano by the right hand and the left hand being sort of vertically coordinated.
Yes.
The things that he played with his right hand against his bass going dum, 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 dum. Unshakable. This was like a rock. And then, you know, it could be 13 and 2/3 or 9 and 19/17. I mean, one would have to transcribe this stuff with a computer because there's no way a human ear could take those. And again, I say he just did this. And he took a tune and moved the melody with all five fingers, you know, going around with never losing the song, the flow of the song, you know, and it sounded absolutely correct.
Isn't it a little bit like the Brahms, the famous Brahms 3-on-2 rhythms?
Yeah, but that's so simple. 3 against 2 ain't nothing.
Bill Evans, a guy that lingers in piano world.
Oh, my goodness, yes. Gosh, he's so high up there, I don't, almost, I'm speechless. He was such a modern-oriented by nature, again, a little bit without really knowing how or why. Mm. And every time I worked him, I hired him many times for some of the recordings I made with Atlantic Records, you know, through John Lewis. He would just play everything down. He could read anything, including one of the maybe the most demanding quasi jazz piece that was ever written, which is the piece called All Set by Milton Babbitt, this very avant-garde composer. Mm-hmm. And that was I commissioned that to be done at a concert in Brandeis University, which is legendary now, that concert. But anyway, it's incredibly complex, atonal, sort of 12-tone music. And many of the musicians, they struggled with this. Art Farmer, I forget who they all were. They just couldn't. It took months and months for them to learn to play this piece. Bill Evans sight-read it. And then the other thing, he was so much interested in the advancing of the harmonic language, which he did. And there is this thing in my autobiography where I suggested to him, because he had mentioned something about Wagner, that he should come to my house every week and we would play through Wagner operas. And he did. He missed very few moments, even though he was pretty high on drugs. He was a little shaky. But anyway, and we sat forehands at the piano, and I played the lower part. And he was, of course, a wonderful. I mean, his hands, he could read anything. So we played through all the late, particularly late operas, Parsifal and the Ring operas. That's in itself, it's almost unbelievable. I've had many people tell me, Gunther, you made that up. You know, but that's how he was. It finally broke off. There was then a moment when he never showed up again. Mm. But that went on for almost a year. I think it was every Wednesday. Yeah, and he was such a dear man and so on. I felt bad for him. And in fact, after this episode, about a half a year later, he started to come to my house. He already knew where I lived, and he came up in the elevator. And he asked for money so I could get some drugs. And I don't know whether it was good or it was very bad and stupid. I gave him some money for whatever he needed for about a half a year. But after a while, I can't keep this on. And yet he played. He then learned to control it, as so many of them, who were on various things, that they found a way of controlling so they could still function fully, And of course, everybody thought if you get high, you're going to play better. Well, let's see. And he had it very bad for a while. But then he saved himself by somehow, I don't know how they control these things.
Yeah.
He never got off it completely, but...
Imagine listening to all the Grammy finalist music across a lot of categories of pop and commercial and small ensemble, big orchestral and serious music. What would we say? What would the Martian landing say about the sound of our culture these days, do you think?
You bring up an interesting question or point. Of course, we have some music which are called commercial. Commercial musics cannot compete with the great musics of our history. And by the way, great musics, I would include Indian music 3,000 years old. So it's not just our European composed music, that we're talking about. Whatever the language is, it doesn't really matter. It is how the composer, whatever he is, you call him pop, you can call him this and that, whatever it is, it has to be done at the very highest creative level that this human being can create, that the human mind can create.
With thanks over many years to Gunther Schuller, we're going out on music that he wrote about ecstatically, performed by men he revered, the late John Lewis of the Modern Jazz Quartet on the piano, and Sonny Rollins, who survives Gunther, on the tenor saxophone. The tune is called The Stopper. Our show was produced by Connor Gillies, Cornell Jasty, and Grant Holub-Mormon, with help from Pat Tomeno and Max Larkin. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.